I think people all over, older people, young people, people who are living in the kind of global village that we're a part of today in our world, really have a lot of pressure on them. There's no possible way for us in the world in which we're living to escape the oppressive pressure that comes into our lives day by day. It comes from outside sources. It comes from just being a part of the world in which we live. It comes from being a part of our society. It comes from, for young people, from drugs. It comes from sex. It comes from temptation at school. It comes from living under the pressure of grades, under the pressure of growing up and being a person. It comes to adults in the business world and in the conflict and the tension of the home situation. It comes to us from every direction. It comes to young people again in Satanism and witchcraft and astrology. It comes from all over the place. And man, it's hard for us really to come to the place where we can understand what it means to believe about anything, you know? The attitude of the world is, man, do your own thing. Be your own person. Cool, man. Don't sweat it. Everything's going to be all right. Hang loose. And yet in the Christian faith, God has given us more than a hang loose theology and a hang loose philosophy. He's given us a way to cope with all these pressures. Not to cop out from it, but to find a realistic and honest solution to all the problems that we face in our lives. A lot of people here this morning who do not know Jesus Christ. It's evident in your life, and you and I both know it. And you're not able to deal with the pressures of your society, and your home, and your job, or your school. And then there's some of us here who've been going along year after year, week after week, and we've been a part of the church, but we've never really discovered the vital life that Jesus Christ has to offer to us. We belong to this church. Well, this morning I want to get the air clear. I want to get the whole thing straight, as much as we can get it straight in the time that we've got. And we want to talk about Jesus Christ and His resurrection. What it means for Him to be alive. The resurrection. Was it a rip-off or was it reality? Is it a rip-off or is it a reality? What does that mean? What does the resurrection of Jesus Christ mean in my life and your life? Was it just some kind of big hoax that somebody perpetrated and said, man, all you stupid Christians believe it by blind faith? Or is it really true? Is it really real? Is it a real possibility for your life? The resurrection, rip off of reality. You know, nobody's ever claimed to be raised from the dead except Jesus Christ and Lazarus, whom He raised Himself. Houdini made the claim. The only problem with him was that he couldn't back it up with his life. Jesus Christ is the only man who's ever been raised from the dead who could back it up with his life and live it. He talked a lot about his resurrection. He talked a lot about being raised from the dead. You know, he said to his disciples over and over and over again, he said, listen, men, he says, we're going down to Jerusalem, and we're going down there. The reason we're going is because I'm going to die. But he said, don't sweat, because 3 days later, I'm going to be raised from the dead. And Peter and a few of the other disciples took him aside and said, Lord, you don't mean that. You got to be kidding. He says, no, man, that's right. That's exactly what's going to happen. His whole life, his whole walk on the earth, his whole incarnation, everything about him living in the flesh was pointing toward two events. One was the cross, and on beyond that was the resurrection. And he said, listen, he says, I'm going to the cross, but in 3 days I'm going to be raised from the dead. And if he wasn't raised from the dead, then Christianity and Jesus Christ and church is a farce. It's a big lie. And for 2,000 years, people have perpetrated a lie. The resurrection of Jesus Christ. Rip off a reality. Jesus Christ, dead or alive. Is he real? Or is it a big hoax? He made the claim that he's alive. That he was the resurrection of the life. And that he could give us life. And I've come to the conclusion that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the greatest, biggest hoax, farce, lie, wicked lie ever perpetrated on mankind. Or it's the truth and it's reality. And if it's reality, then we're responsible to examine those claims, to look at those claims, and to say, and to reflect our lives in light of those claims, and to put our life before them and say, my life belongs to those claims of the reality of Jesus Christ. Was it a lie? Or was it the truth? There's all kinds of evidence that begins to crop up, that begins to show us that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a reality. And we want to look at it this morning. You say, well, man, listen, so, you know, Christianity's fine with me, but you know, what about Hinduism and Buddhism and some of these things? You know, what about some of these other religions and all that kind of thing, man? They're okay. Baloney. You know why it's baloney? Because all these other religions are based on philosophical presuppositions. Christianity is the only religion based on historical event, the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And if it's true, you have to put your life in light of it. What are some of the evidence that comes along and that we look at, you know? What are some of the things that make the resurrection of Jesus Christ a reality or a ripoff? Well, for 429 years, no one ever refuted the resurrection of Jesus Christ. For 429 years, no one ever wrote one word to refute the resurrection of Jesus Christ after he was raised from the dead. Matthew Arnold has said, the great scholar has said, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the best attested fact in history. Wow, man. Are we supposed to believe in just blind faith? Or is there something we can put our teeth into, something we can really believe, something we can stand on, something that we as Christians can have an authority in? Let's look at some of the evidence of testimony. There's a guy named Simon Greenleaf, and Simon Greenleaf was one of the great law professors in the history of law. His textbook, The Laws of Legal Evidence, has been used in law schools across the country for years. The Laws of Legal Evidence. And in his classes, he used to make cock out of Christianity. He used to say it was a hoax, it was a farce. And one day a couple of his students came up to him and said, listen, prof, he said, how about if you just check into the thing and do a study and see if the resurrection of Jesus Christ will stand up in a court of law? They challenged him. He said, that's fair enough. I'll take the challenge. And so he put all his energy and all his effort into seeing if he could disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ so that it would not stand up in a court of law. And the conclusion he came to after deep and serious study was that the resurrection of Jesus Christ would stand up in any court of law in any court in this country. Or any country for that matter. And he made the statement that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the most established fact in history and will stand up in any court of law. There were two guys, one Gilbert Benjamin West and Ward Littleton, and both of these guys were professors at Oxford. You know, that is a pretty good school, you know. And these guys were out to disprove Jesus Christ. They knew that if they could, Jesus Christ was probably a pretty good moral person, but they really didn't believe this garbage about his resurrection and the conversion of Paul and all that kind of thing. And so they set out to disprove two things. They said they could make the whole thing a hoax, the whole thing a farce, if they would disprove the resurrection of Christ and the conversion of Paul on the Damascus Road. So that's what they set out to do. And they went off for a 6-month study leave, They decided that one of them would take the resurrection of Christ, and one of them would take the conversion of Paul, and they would study it for 6 months and do that. They would come back and report their findings and see what they came up with. Well, they took off and were gone for 6 months, and when they came back, both of them, when they came together in their first meeting, were really sheepish, really, you know, really kind of had their head down, kind of embarrassed. Because what had happened was that in their study and in their scholarly research, both of them had come to the conclusion that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was a reality, and the conversion of St. Paul was a reality, and could be substantiated from a scholarly point of view. It would stand up under scholarly research. And during that time, both of them gave their lives to Jesus Christ because of what they found out. And in the flyleaf of the book that they printed as a result of their research were the words, "Reject not until you have examined the evidence." And boy, there are a lot of people rolling around today who just blindly, blatantly, and without thinking, without doing any research, just in a stupid type of way, say, "Man, I'm casting Jesus Christ off, man. You can't feed me that garbage." And the reason they say that is because they haven't been intellectually honest enough. They haven't been serious enough. They haven't been seeking enough to really take the time to really examine the evidence that's there and to find out whether Jesus Christ is really real or whether he's not. The resurrection of Jesus Christ ripped off a reality. At least some people begin to think that it's a reality. And they haven't all been stupid and all leaped out in blind faith. I'll tell you what I want us to do this morning. I want us to look at some of the evidence. And I want us to check it out and just see what we can find. Now, it's obvious that in the time we've got, in the shortness of the time here, that we cannot possibly look into all evidence of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But I'm hoping that out of this, some of you will take the time to really begin to look and see if it can be substantiated or not. But we can look pretty seriously into it this morning, and that's what I want us to do. I want us to look first at Matthew 27. And the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is really, it's a kind of thing that can be substantiated not only from a biblical point of view, but from an extra-biblical and from a non-biblical point of view. And the first thing I want us to look at is the empty tomb. This is Matthew's version of what happened to Jesus Christ when he was raised from the dead. Was he dead or was he alive? Let's check it out. Matthew 27, beginning with the 59th verse, it says, "And Joseph took the body and he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and he laid it in his own new tomb." Now you have to understand about this linen cloth and the new tomb. See, the new tomb was a solid rock. It was a cave that had been carved out, and was a solid rock, and inside of that was a stone slab. And on that, there were three stone slabs, as a matter of fact, and on each one of those stone slabs, they would put a body. And each one of the stone slabs went back into the wall of the cave, and the head protruded back into the wall. And they would lay the body or the corpse on top of this slab in this solid rock. That was the new tomb. And then the linen cloth, what they did was they brought the body in, they laid it on the stone slab, and after they laid it on the slab, they brought in all the spices, 100 pounds of spices, and they began to wrap the body and almost mummify. What they did was they started with this linen cloth, and they took myrrh and aloes and a gummy substance, and they began to mix it all in together. And as they wrapped the body, they smeared this gummy substance on the cloth, and they began to wrap it around the body. They wrapped it around the legs, and then they wrapped it around the waist and the body, and then they wrapped it around the armpits and up around until they got around the neck. And they wrapped the whole body like this, and after they had wrapped it all up and gotten it all like this, then what they did, according to the Jewish burial custom, was they left the body there inside of this tomb, and inside of this mummified case, and it would harden, and it would weigh somewhere between 100 and 115 pounds. Man, that's a lot of pounds. And so they laid the body in the new tomb, and they wrapped the linen cloth around it,
says, and he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb, and he went away. Now, what does that mean? What's a large stone that they rolled in front of the tomb? Well, it was a kind of, maybe it's just a little yard rock they put in there, maybe something you just, you find out in the street somewhere and you just kind of shove it into a little hole there. Well, it wasn't exactly that kind of rock. It was the kind of rock that when you see it, you say something like this, you say, "Golly, get a load of that rock." That kind of rock, see? That's the kind of rock it was. It weighed somewhere between 1.5 and 2 tons. It would fit a 4.5-foot doorway. Mark says that it was a large stone. Some of the early manuscripts say that it would take 20 men to move this kind of a stone, this kind of a rock. And they had the rock. The rock was there. And what they did is the tomb was kind of down in a crevice type of thing. And you entered the door as you stepped down into this crevice. And then what they did is they had this large round stone, 1.5 to 2 tons, at the top of the little hill there. And what they do is when they wanted to close up the tomb, they just roll the stone down the hill and go, and fall into place. And obviously there was no way to get out of there. They were taking all kinds of precautions. They were putting Jesus in a new tomb. They were wrapping him in a linen cloth so that he couldn't get out of there. They had rolled the stone over there, and there was no way for him to get out. They were taking every precaution to make sure that the grave of Jesus Christ was going to be secure, that the tomb would not be empty, so that nobody could get in and nobody could get out. And it goes on to say that Mary Magdalene was there and the other Mary sitting opposite the grave. And now on the next day, which is the one after the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.' Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day, lest the disciples come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He is risen from the dead.' And then the last deception will be worse than the first." Well, they were taking every precaution to make sure that Jesus didn't get out, because they knew the claims that he had made. And then it says, Pilate said to them, "You have a guard. Go in and make it as secure as you know how." You have a guard. Go and make it as secure as you know how. Now, what's a guard? Well, in Sunday school, we've always learned from the pictures that are on the wall that they're usually two little Mickey Mouse little guys roaming around there with wooden spears and mini skirts on. And here they are, guarding the tomb of Jesus. And yet that is not exactly what it was like, see? Because the reality of it is that a guard was a 16-man security unit that was a part of the best military system in the world. One of the best that's ever been assembled. And these 16 men, each one of them was responsible for 6 square feet. And they could protect those 6 square feet with their life and not be defeated. And so when you had a 16-man security unit protecting 6 square feet, you had 36 square yards covered, and nobody could get through. The guy who designed this is Flavius Rigidius Renatus. Well, how'd you like to have a name like that? Well, that'd be horrible, wouldn't it? We'll just call him Rigid for short, okay? So we don't have to go through that every time. But Rigid was the guy who designed this military unit. And he designed this guard, this security unit. And he was the man who put the whole thing together and trained the Roman army to be this kind of top-notch, top-flight security, this top-flight military guard. In fact, the Green Beret of the United States Army uses the same tactics, the same process, the same theories, the same text that Flavius Rigidius Renatus used in the first century, who trained the guys who was guarding the tomb of Jesus. Now, man, there wasn't any way for Jesus to get out of there, see? They had taken every precaution, and the guards were there. And then it says, and they went and made the grave secure, and along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. Now, what that meant was they set the seal of the emperor on the stone. Now, this is the final precaution. They took some rawhide and they put it at the top
on the solid rock, and then they put it over the stone that was rolled down there. And they put a clay pack on the top and clay pack down here, and then they did the same thing on the other side, the rawhide, the clay pack on the top, the clay pack on the bottom, and they put the emperor's seal on every one of those clay packs. And if anybody broke one of those seals, you know what happened? Dead. The soldiers were responsible for that, and anybody who meddled with that and meddled with the seal of the emperor was a dead man. So you can begin to see that at the tomb of Jesus Christ, they took a lot of precautions, right? They weren't about to let that guy get out of there. Man, he was stuck in there. And yet people have had all kinds of theories about how he got out, because he did get out. Somehow he got out of there. And people have had all kinds of theories about how he got out. One of the theories is that the Roman Jewish authorities wanted him out. And this is an interesting theory, because of all the people that would not bring him out would be the Roman and Jewish authorities. I mean, after all, they were the guys who put him in there. They were the guys who made all these precautions that we just talked about. Now, why would they want him out of there? They wouldn't want him out. They wanted him to stay in there. And besides that, a couple of weeks later, when the disciples were running around saying, "Jesus is alive, Jesus is alive, Jesus is alive," and these guys were trying to put them down and put them down and put them down to the point where they were persecuting them, killing them, clobbering them, bringing them into court and putting them into jail and all kinds of things. The very simple solution to that would have been, it's so easy, so simple, all they had to do was produce the body. Go to the tomb, get it out, say, "Man, Jesus isn't alive. Here he is. Here's his body." Somehow, they never could quite come up with that. Theory has a lot of holes in it. There's another theory that the disciples stole the body. And this is an interesting theory too, boy. This is an exciting theory, you know. Because these disciples, you know, here was this guard. And the guard was there, the 16-man security unit, the best in the whole Roman Empire was there guarding the tomb of Jesus. And the disciples, in the dark, came to this guard. And see, the guard had to, if anybody broke this seal, what they did was they killed the guard, and when they killed them, the way they killed them was that they took all their clothes that they had on and they stripped them. And they put the clothes around them. And they built a fire and they burned these men in their own clothes. That'd be kind of a tragic death, wouldn't it? And these guys knew that if anybody broke that seal, that they would lose their life. And they knew that nobody was going to break that seal. If they got sleepy, if they got tired, if they had to stay up all night, man, they would have been standing there around there beating each other on the head with their swords to make sure they were awake. Because they weren't about to let anybody get in there. And so the theory here is the disciples came and stole the body. And here come these 11 teenage, scruffy, you know, meek and mild little disciples, you know. The only one who had any kind of strength at all was Peter. And here come these 11 little guys. And they kind of come sneaking up through there in the dark, you know. Tiptoe through the tulips, you know. And they come on through there, and they come over to the guard, you know. And they sneak up on these guys, and these 11 guys, these 11 scruffy little disciples, take the greatest military in the force in the world, and they go, pow, 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 and they clobber them off. Pretty good method, huh? And so they... The disciples get in there and they sack all these military men, all these great Roman soldiers, these 11 little guys, and then these 11 little guys take that 2-ton stone and they push it away. And then they go in and get out the body of Jesus and they take it before he's been raised from the dead. No way. Come on, man. You believe that, you've got to be a hotshot believer. Right? You gotta have some real faith to believe in that. There was another theory that the ladies went to the wrong tomb. And that's why they thought Jesus was alive. The ladies went to the wrong tomb, and the disciples went to the wrong tomb, and then the other 500 went to the wrong tomb, and Christians have been going to the wrong tomb ever since. You know? No way. And then there was one other really interesting theory produced by a supposed intellectual here in our country, Schoenfield. He was in the Passover plot. He was a proponent of the swoon theory. And in this theory, he simply said that Jesus was on the cross, but when he was on the cross, he didn't really die. They took him down before he died. They put him in the tomb. They put all these things around him. They put him in there. And while he was in the tomb, you know what happened? He was all encased in all this stuff, and the stone slab, and this cold tomb. And while he was in there, the coolness of the tomb revived him. And he came back alive. And he tore off all those wrappings, up 115 pounds, it was all around him, recovered from being on the cross for 6 hours, rolled away the 2-ton stone, and walked out alive. Some of these professors need to examine their brains. Come on, man. Get serious. The only way that body could have gotten out of that tomb, the only possible way that anything could have happened was the power of God working in that thing, because Jesus Christ came out alive. There is no other way to look at it. There is no other way intellectually, spiritually, or any other way that you can come to this and come away from it saying that Jesus Christ was not alive. And you've got to deal with that. Somewhere in your life, you've got to deal with that. Jesus Christ was not a rip-off. He was a reality. His resurrection was not a rip-off. It was a reality. And he walked down there alive that day. The tomb was empty. The way it got empty was that he came out of there by the power of God, who raised him from the dead and gave him life. But there's a lot of other evidence. Let's take a quick look at another one over in John 20. If you want to turn over there with me. This is not the first evidence is the evidence of the empty tomb, and the next evidence is the evidence of the undisturbed grave clothes. Now, the undisturbed grave clothes is really... It's really fantastic because this is John's view of what happened. He was there, and he was in the tomb, and he gives his point of view on what happened. This is his evidence for the resurrection. Let's begin to read. It says, "Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb, and while it was still dark, and she saw the tomb already taken away from the tomb. And so she ran, and she came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.'" Now Mary Magdalene had heard Jesus say he was going to be raised from the dead, and she'd heard him say it several times. And she went to the tomb, and she found that he wasn't there, and she began to hope. But she was really afraid to believe. She was afraid to believe that anything like this could even possibly happen. And so she went running back to Simon Peter and to John. And it's kind of like the way you are, some of you kids are, when you get a test paper back, you know? You've taken a big exam, final exam. And you can't tell whether you made an A or whether you made an F. Right? A lot of those tests, right? And so you come into class and you know that one day, and you know the teacher's going to give the test back. And you walk into class, man, and your palms are sweating. And you're nervous. And you come in there and you sit down, and the teacher walks in with the test paper, and man, your heart starts pumping. And you walk in there, and you sit down, and she comes in with the test papers, and then she says, "We're going to wait till after class to get back the test papers." And you say, "Oh, no, I can't stand it." And then in a few minutes, as the class goes on, man, you get more and more nervous, more and more uptight, the adrenaline's flowing more and more, because, man, this is your whole grade, you might not get into college if you don't get this one. At the end of the class, she starts handing out the papers. And she starts alphabetically. She starts with A, and your name starts with Z. And she goes down through there, man, and she just begins to give them out. And you get more and more nervous every paper she gives out. And finally she gets to your paper, man, you're so nervous and so shook that you grab the paper and you're even afraid to look at it, and you stuff it in your pocket. And you say, "Man, I can't bear to look. I'll look at it later." And that's exactly what happened to Mary Magdalene. She was hoping, she was thinking, she was praying. She thought, maybe. But she was afraid to even look. To go into the tomb and look. And so she runs back to Peter and John, and then read what happened. It says that Peter therefore went forth from the other disciple, and they were going to the tomb.
And the two were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first and stooping in. He looked and he saw the letter wrapping lying there. Well, see, here you got Peter and John, and Mary Magdalene had gone back to them, and Peter and John were there. And she tells Peter and John. Now, John was a member of the Jerusalem High School track team, see? And man, he takes off because he knew that what Jesus said about his resurrection. And he starts off, man, and he takes off. You know, and he sprints down the road and he comes down to the place, you know. And Peter played tackle on the football team. And he was a little slower. He was slow, but he was dumb. See, one of those kind of guys. He was slow and dumb, and Peter said that John takes off, choo, right down through there, and Peter goes, duh. And he starts running down through there. And John has already sprinted out, man. He's taken off. And he's running down through there, and he gets down to the tomb first, and all of a sudden, he gets there, and he's sprinting down through there, and all of a sudden, he goes, and he comes to a screeching halt. You know why he comes to a screeching halt? Because all of a sudden it dawns upon him that it is still dark and he's in the middle of a graveyard and there's a body missing and there are all kinds of weird things happening around him. And he's scared. But Peter, he's dumb. And he comes lumbering on down to you. He gets down there. What does he do? Man, he doesn't think about being scared. He just kind of right on into the tomb. He doesn't even think about it. And John's still scared to death. When Peter goes by, you know, so slow, he just kind of reaches out and he grabs Peter's belt. And they just kind of go in. He goes in looking around Peter, checking the whole situation out. And they get in the tomb, and you know what happens? They look around, and what do they see? It says four times in this passage, it says they saw the linen wrappings lying there. They saw the linen wrappings lying there. There was no body in the linen wrappings. They were there. Somebody had come out of those things. And you know what they saw over in the corner? They put a mask over a person's face who had died. They put a cloth over it. And over in the corner, they saw the death mask folded up, lying neatly in the corner. And all of a sudden, it hit him. The linen wrappings lying there. Jesus said he's going to be raised from the dead. He says he's going to be raised from the dead. The linen wrappings are lying there. Here we are. He's not here. He's gone. And all of a sudden, it hit him. Jesus Christ is alive. He's alive. He is really alive. He said he's done what he said he was going to do. He's come back from the dead. He is alive. And now they went around shouting it all over the countryside. Because what the Bible says right here, it says they saw and they believed. They saw what had happened and they believed what Jesus had said. And they began to realize the reality of the fact that Jesus Christ is really alive. Is he alive in your life? Have you seen and believed? Have you realized that the linen wrappings are just lying there and Jesus Christ is alive in the world today? The potential for living in your life? Boy, the evidence is there. There's more evidence. There's all kinds of evidence. There's evidence of the appearances. Jesus appeared 10 times during the 40 days that he was on earth alive. Before he ascended to the Father, he saw 500 people. And 500 people do not have hallucinations. Psychologists will tell you that. Don't have the same hallucination. Not only that, his disciples' lives were changed. They were different men. Peter and John had been scared shitless the week before. They'd been so scared that Peter denied him. They'd hidden out in the upper room. Every time somebody opened the door, man, they jumped. They were sitting up there just for 2 weeks. They'd been biting their fingernails because they're afraid somebody was going to come and kill them. And all of a sudden, they came out of there, and they found out that Jesus Christ was alive, and they went around proclaiming it, telling the whole world, Jesus Christ is alive. And you know who they proclaimed it to in Acts 4? They proclaimed it to the very court, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of the country. They proclaimed it to those guys, the same court that had tried Jesus Christ. They testified, Jesus is alive, with boldness, the Bible says. Now, how can a guy do that? Man, something has to happen in his life for him to be able to do that. They realized that Jesus Christ was really alive, and he can live in them. That's what happened to him. James is a fantastic example. Here he is, the brother of Jesus. All through his life, he thought Jesus was some kind of kook freak. He thought it was weird. I mean, after all, wouldn't you? What if your brother went around saying, I'm the resurrection of life, I'm the true vine, I'm the door, you know? Man, you'd say, what a weirdo. Who says things like that? Some of you think your brother and sister are stupid anyway, you know? What if your brother went around saying all those kind of weird things? Man, you'd have somebody come and lock him up. You'd reject him. You'd say, man, get away. And that's exactly what James did. His family tried to put him away. And James was probably standing there before the cross when Jesus was on it. He was there with his mother Mary, and he was probably saying to Jesus, Jesus, you stupid idiot. He said, I told you so. I told you you'd finally get yourself killed. You kept going around saying all those things. See where it's gotten you? Now you're dead. James lost his life. He gave up his life because he found out that Jesus Christ really was alive. And in his book, he says, James, a slave of Jesus Christ, a bondservant of Jesus Christ. Now, how can a guy make a transition from that to the other? The only possible way is that something happens in his life. He begins to realize that something is really real, and it happens to him. And he began to realize that Jesus Christ was really alive, and he saw him, and he experienced him, and he knew it was true. He gave his life. What he knew to be the truth. That experience has happened to me. It's happened to Christians down through the years.